And it is coffee time. And we've got the men on the line, and I'll push the right button and bring them on. Good morning, Will.
Good morning.
And good morning, Tim.
Good morning.
And, Will, why don't you start us off with a word of prayer this morning?
Sure. Heavenly Father, we come to you this morning asking for you to bless this conversation we're about to have. And Lord, I thank you for these men and their willingness to serve you and your kingdom. Lord, I pray blessings on them and their families and ask for your protection over them. Thank you, Lord, for all of those who are tuning in. We pray, Lord, that this conversation will serve to train, equip, and uplift the people out there. And, Lord, so that they may serve you as warriors. We pray, Lord, for the remnant and ask for your healing on those that are sick and comfort those who are down and fuel those who are on fire for you. Lord, we ask you to prepare our people for what is to come, and we pray, Lord, that you will use us as vessels just to pour out the truth in this land of lies. We pray your protection and blessings over Scriptures for America, and thank you, Lord, for the promise of an exciting future for us and the ministry. And we just thank you, Lord, for these things, and we ask it in your holy name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, sir. Appreciate that. Well, I got to tell you, since last week in coffee, and since I'm drinking a cup of coffee right now, I did stock up on coffee. So I appreciate the prepper tip of the week as far as being educated on the upcoming coffee shortage. And it was kind of interesting because I called a couple places and talked to them about coffee this week, and they said, it's not coming. They said it's kind of here. And they said that there's been a huge run on organic coffee recently. And I guess it's been all over the news, according to some people, and I just haven't, I guess I've missed it. But the dangers of drinking non-organic coffee and the molds and stuff that's been in there, I guess it's kind of a big health craze going on, and everybody wants to just start drinking organic coffee right now, which that's, we've been trying to do that for a long time whenever possible. And anyway, it was interesting because several places were completely sold out of organic coffee, and they said that they just can't even get the beans. I talked to a local coffee roaster and just happened to run into her in the post office, but she sets up at the farmers markets and stuff around here, and said that I asked her about, you know, what she had for bulk bags of organic coffee, and she says nothing. She says, I have no organic beans at all, and can't even get any. So anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting, but sitting here drinking a cup of coffee, and I figured that I just mentioned that. It was just interesting, but I did get stocked up on some coffee. So we'll see. That's one of the things that I don't want to run out of.
Yeah. Me either.
It's funny. It's funny. Also, as I'm drinking coffee, I bought something that I felt like my grandparents or something, because it's not something I drink, but I decided, since we were talking about it last Saturday, I bought a huge canister of freeze dried coffee. I just decided to go that route. And, I actually found, it's kind of funny, kind of full circle of everything we've been talking about recently. I had to spend a little extra money, but there is a company that's based out of South Africa that actually makes like an organic freeze-dried coffee. And I was able to find that, and I bought that, and my wife has been kind of dividing it up in mason jars and vac sealing it in the mason jars so that it's not just this one gigantic open container. And it's not bad. It's not bad coffee at all. I'm not a huge instant coffee kind of guy, but I'll tell you, if it's that versus hot water, I'll take the instant coffee.
So it is an instant coffee. Add it to hot water. That's what you do.
It is a freeze dried coffee. Yeah. And it's kind of old school. It has been some number of years since I've drank a coffee chicory blend.
Yeah.
But it is a coffee chicory blend. And yesterday probably drank 3 cups of it just to test it out. My 10-year-old wanted a cup, and he agreed it was pretty doggone good coffee. And I don't know if I would want to drink it every day as my go-to cup of coffee, but if I didn't have coffee, then it would be a good thing to go with. And now that we got it packaged up, and I think the wife was putting it in pint jars, maybe quart jars, and I'm thinking about it, and you know, you vac seal it with an oxygen absorber in it, I think it'll sit shelf stable for quite some time.
Good idea. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
I've always kept it around too, and it's nice for things like power outages, camping, different things, because you can almost always find or make water hot enough to do it, but the brew angle can be a little tough sometimes. So, but like you said, I don't know if I want to drink it all the time, but it sure beats the alternative.
That's right. And as good Americans, we should remember, you know, we fought a bloody war so we wouldn't have to drink tea.
Yeah.
So coffee, we should be fighting for. Keep it in stock.
Exactly. let's go to kind of world news. Over in Haiti right now, it's been interesting. I was looking at some of the stuff that talks about Eric Prince coming over, taking over, using ex-military forces to try to get the gang activity under control. And I don't know. That was interesting. I know last week, I think that it was, they said that there was a bunch of people being killed, and I started looking back through it, and it just seems like every week there's being people killed over there. The gang violence is just absolutely crazy, and it's, it's just a mess over there. What do you guys know about that?
I know that Haiti is kind of a toilet of a country. And it looks like they've called in the plumbers to come do something about that. And Eric Prince, you know, he's a former, he was an officer in the United States Navy. He was a Navy SEAL. And I think a lot of the listeners, if they don't know him by name, they probably remember hearing in the news 20 years ago or so about Blackwater, which is a private military company, private military contractor. That was used in the Middle East. He's a legit guy. He's a no-nonsense legit guy. He was educated at Hillsdale College, very conservative man, professes to be a Christian. He's a Catholic. A wealthy guy, and it sounds like he is taking a contract from the country of Haiti, the government of Haiti, to go in and wipe these criminal gangs that are looting and raping and pillaging and killing all over the country, to wipe them off the face of the earth. And reading up on it, Jason, it sounds like he is recruiting Haitian American soldiers, former soldiers, and getting up a strength, a cadre of soldiers to go down there and to act under the auspices of the Haitian government. And I got a strong feeling that he'll be successful.
Okay, what's a Haitian American? Is that somebody from Haiti that came and went to? I mean, did we even let those guys in our military? What is that exactly?
So, I just lost power. Okay.
Oh.
So I'll keep talking, and maybe it'll come back on. My understanding of this, Jason, is, you know, the three of us talking now, I'm using the lingo of what they use. Us, we're Americans, right? That's all. I wouldn't say that I'm a Scot-Irish American, you know, or from that descent or whatever, just like you wouldn't say you're a German American or whatever. My understanding are these off again and on again, there's been these boatloads of Haitians that have shown up and claimed asylum and got legitimized and given citizenship. And that is my understanding of what this is. Okay. My understanding of what this is it's those people who have been in the country for a little while, maybe second generation, that have ended up joining the military and serving as soldiers, and have gotten out of the military. That's what he is recruiting to go back into their ancestral homeland, is what it sounds like to me.
Because these people, don't they, like every so many years, just rise up and just decide that they're going to kill everybody and just, you know, basically go into a machete fight and chop everybody up, I think, is what happens over there.
Yeah, I think that's... that's their heritage, and you guys may know more about this, Tim. You may know. I know this isn't new. About the only time that Haiti was civil is when the French were doing the day-to-day operation and ruling over that country. And once they had the bloody revolt against the French, I think it's pretty much been downhill ever since, wouldn't you say, Tim?
Oh, yeah. Haiti's definitely been like a dog bone. I mean, they've just... you know, been passed around and shook, and there's a shakedown goes on down there. I mean, it's extremely gang oriented, a lot of vice as far as on the government level, even. I mean, you get things done with money over there, but that's the way to get things done. Yeah, a lot of blackmail. Obviously, lately, a lot of cannibalism. I mean, I don't know, you know, that it's, it's a debauched country. I think that's the right word for it. I mean, it just has, I know that, and if you look into its history, and I think Jason talked about this in one of the other ones, but there's a lot of voodoo and a lot of that kind of stuff goes on over there. And it's the moral codes on those things are, they're off the chart. I mean, and so I think what you see here is, you know, the reflection of the religious or moral fabric of the society as a result. There's good people over there. There's no doubt about it. I mean, there gets to be less with every uprising because they either leave or
they die.
Or die. Yeah.
Or they're killed. Yeah.
So I
looked this up, Tim, just because I knew it. I just couldn't get the dates in my head. But, you know, I'm sure y'all have heard about it and others have heard about it. But on the eve of the revolution where the blacks were going to go after the white Frenchmen, it was August 14th, 1791, a group of Houngans, which are voodoo priests there in Haiti. They were led by a former slave named Boukman, and they made a pact with the devil at a place called Boys Cayman. And they vowed that if the devil, if Satan, would allow them to exterminate all the white Frenchmen, that they would dedicate Haiti to the service of Satan. And that revolution was successful. They drove the French out. So that's the origins of this country that we keep talking about with Haiti. You know, in the past, when we were talking about all of these Haitian immigrants and that sort of stuff coming here, that's the quality of people. You know, they found their country on that.
Wow.
That doesn't sound like a fun place to go.
And I know, well, you know, just talking about the Haitian people, too, it's I've known people that well, let's just say that they love everybody. And until they rented houses to Haitians that came over here after the, I don't know if it was the earthquake or what happened, but it was a couple years ago. We had a huge influx of Haitians coming over here, and I can't remember what year that was, but the people that rented houses to Haitians got to the point where they hated Haitians. They said that they were the most disgusting, destructive people that they've ever met. And I've talked to a lot of people that were, I've never been around Haitians. I've seen them, you know, and I know that, you know, they're around, never worked with them, never been around them very much, but everybody that I've talked to that's spent much time around them says they are very, very different people to be around. Very destructive, very dirty, very unclean, very strange and evil. And I'm not saying that all of them is. I mean, that's boxing them in like. And I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying that there's something definitely different there.
Well, I think it's that, yeah, what Will was saying, I think it's that commission to Satan. I mean, there's just, they have driven out, and really, if you go back and look at all these uprisings that they've had, and there's so many of them, it's tough to tell. And then, but they have destroyed, the Christian element was the first thing targeted over there. I mean, every mm-hmm. time there was an uprising, they tried to stomp those people into the ground. And, you know, and then we see all of the natural disasters that have hit Haiti. I mean, they're in the news every other week for some hurricane or some, typhoon or different things like that. So, it's not wrong. And
just to jump on what you were saying about God not being mocked there, Tim, they share an island. There's one island that is divided in half. And part of the one half of the island is the Dominican Republic. And then one half of the island is Haiti. And all of these things that are going on, and they're kind of divided by a mountain range there, but all of these things that are going on in Haiti are not going on in the Dominican Republic. And they sit on the same island, you know, and you would think if these natural disasters with the hurricanes and the earthquakes and, you know, they're just destroying these natural disasters are destroying Haiti. That's not happening in the Dominican Republic. I wonder why.
Yeah.
Probably because the Dominican Republic wasn't founded on, you know, we, like you said, Tim, a commission that we dedicate ourselves to the service of Satan. So I think God will not be mocked. I think that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's there for all to see. And it's definitely one of those, situations when you if you go bother to look into it, it's just another, I call them, you know, oh, to coin someone else's phrase, it's like a sign, you know. I mean,
sure,
just there it is, take a look at it. God scattered them all over. We got Venezuela, we got and these, they're going on. So you want to march down that road, this is where you end up. So
One of the attacks last week, just in one tackle alone, from what I understand, they killed over 50 people, grabbed a 86-year-old pastor out of a church and beheaded him. And I think that's what they like to behead people, and then burn them. And
they like the blood, Jason. It's not just enough to shoot them. You know, they have to brutalize them. They like the blood. And I think that in itself is satanic in origin. You know, they have to spill the blood of the innocent. And I think that is, I'm not going to sit here and say that DNA got changed when they sold their soul to the devil as a nation or anything like that. But it sure seems like, as a people, they have a bloodlust. And I think that ties in directly with their service to Satan. I think that's what Satan demands is that type of carnage.
Yeah, it's demonic infiltration, influence, and even outright possession. I mean, that's when you see that kind of those kinds of brutality, those kinds of evil intent. I don't know what else. What other conclusion can you draw?
I don't think any of us, you know, us three men that are talking right now are, what's the word? I spook easily. But if you really look into voodoo and Santeria and what these natives there, the Haitian people, what is ingrained in their culture and what they practice, it's spooky. It is, you can call it whatever you want. It's just satanic. It, you know, they do things that are, I won't even talk about. I mean, it's a scary stuff. And that is what is the majority in their country. That's not the minority. That's not a handful of people that have some weird beliefs. you know, that is what their the width and breadth of their population, what they believe and what they practice. And quite frankly, part of me says leave them alone and just let them deal with themselves, and hopefully they'll go away. And then part of me thinks this movement of Eric Prince going in there with his mercenaries, you know, I don't really know what it'll do other than just reestablish another government that will be ran by Haitians, and we'll do all this stuff again probably in 10 years.
Well, that's what I was thinking. It's like, okay, we go in there and clean up the problem, then who are we going to turn power over to? They get in there, they clean it up, and it's like, okay, is there going to be anybody left? Number one. Number two is, what's going to happen after that? I mean, this could be an ongoing 10-year war. You just never know.
Sure, good. Yeah, that's the right question, too. What are they going to do with it afterwards?
We've got a caller. Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phone lines. Hello, caller. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
No, who is this?
This is Jason.
I'm on the air. Is Richard there?
No, he's not. Can you call back? We're on the radio right now.
Oh, so sorry.
All right, thank you. Okay. Well, it is live radio, that's for sure.
Live radio. Yeah.
I don't know. It'll just be interesting to see what happens. That's for sure.
Well, and they're definitely getting what they paid for, or what they bid for, or what they wanted. This is an example of this melting pot philosophy and this, I'm not going to say plurality of religions, I'm going to say plurality of gods. You know, I mean, if you want to see what it brings out, this is what you're looking at. This is what comes to those places that do that, is they devolve into it's maniacal. You know, there's no sense, there's no reason, there's no, it's just destruction. And that's what,
just chaos.
You know, the God told us that Satan is a destroyer. That's what he wants. And there's, you know, the problem for most of us that are God-serving Christian people is you're over there trying to make some kind of sense out of it. Like, what do they want? What's the goal? What are they attempting to? No, this is the goal. That's what they want. This is the machine. This is the final outcome of it. They're not, you know, it's just death and destruction and chaos and, you know, all of these evil things. And that's the end product, and that's the desire of what they want. So it's not, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, and I'm wondering, too, one of the other things is, how does Haiti have the money to pay for this? I mean, these Blackwater, what's the new? What's
Jason.
The, yes.
Academi.
Okay. How do they?
Yeah, that's the new place.
Yeah, somebody's got to be paying that, because, I mean, does Haiti have the money to pay for something like that to come in there? I mean, I wouldn't think that they would, but maybe they got money.
No, they don't have money. I mean, their only industry is like machete sharpening. That's all they do there. It's no doubt in my mind, and I don't pretend to be an authority on this, but Eric Prince is very ingrained in the United States military industrial complex. He is very ingrained with the Trump family, a huge donor, huge supporter, has appeared with Mr. Trump during the campaigns. He's a made man, so to speak. And
okay.
my personal opinion, without having one shred of proof, is the government of Haiti is not paying for anything. I think it is the United States government paying for this, because they are a southern neighbor that we probably want to stabilize, and then exploit.
Right.
And the way I think that we will exploit them is Port-au-Prince, Haiti, is an incredibly strategic port, naval port, that has not been able to be used for decades now because of this unrest. So I think it's going to be the same old game of probably government and nation building, and we're going to, instead of sending our own troops, we're going to send this private military contractor to go down there and clean it up, and then you will see a U.S.-occupied portion of Haiti, and I think we will just use them as a default U.S. port. That's my opinion.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's definitely not going to be one of the places that cruise ships are going to be going or anything like that, though, I don't think, anytime in the near future.
Don't think so. I don't think so. No.
And at one time it was, but, yeah, I think it's interesting. From 2011 to 2021, which is, 10 years, I think, over that 10-year condition there, we sent them $13 billion in foreign aid.
Mm-hmm.
That was... So, you know, who's paying for it? It's like normal. It's, it comes back to the industrial military complex. That's what it's all about. So, and,
I don't know the next time we'll talk about Haiti, so I just want to say this real fast. We were talking about the Clinton Chronicles and that kind of stuff last weekend. I would encourage people to look into the Clinton role in the country of Haiti, because that time frame that you were just talking about, Tim, that kind of 2008, that right around the hurricane, 2011, the Clinton Foundation had a pivotal role in the country of Haiti, and they were pretty much not the United States, but while Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State, when she was holding that office, the Clinton Foundation were kind of the default rulers of Haiti, and they were controlling all aid coming into the country of Haiti. And when I say control, I don't mean like they were being benevolent and making sure that everyone was being fed and had medicine and clean water. I mean, like, they were equipping warlords there, by giving food to this aid to the warlords to distribute in Haiti. And that's just a recipe for disaster. But in turn, the warlords were providing children to be trafficked. That sounds crazy, but I'm telling you, if you do the research, it's there. The Clintons were all wrapped up in Haiti. And I personally know a man who is a very, very wealthy man who was attempting to fly in supplies to Haiti, and he was being stopped by the United States government from entering that airspace to drop. When I say fly, I mean him personally flying in on his jet, his Learjet, to drop supplies. And he was being prohibited by the U.S. government because the Clintons did not want the supplies going directly to those who need it. And it's just a crazy story. But when you talk about architects of chaos and serving Satan, just to me, it makes sense that the Clintons would be neck deep in all of that. Sorry. I just wanted to throw that out there.
No, I'm glad. Good time to get it in.
Good talk. Yeah.
Well, war over in Haiti, and exporting Chinese students from the United States. I don't know. That is interesting. I don't know if anybody else heard about that, but Rubio State's department will begin revoking Chinese student visas. So I don't know. It was on a tweet this a couple of days ago on the 28th. It says the U.S. will begin revoking visas of Chinese students, including those with connections to the Chinese Communist Party or studying in critical fields. So that could be kind of interesting to see what happens there and how that unfolds.
It's kind of all four closing the box door after everybody's gotten in, after all the horses got out. But yeah, exactly. So
I think.
I mean, you know what?
Piggyback on the hate.
Go ahead.
No, no. I was just going to say real fast, maybe we can stabilize Haiti and then send all the Haitians that came here back. Kind of along the same subject, is this is a great step to and the reason I say that is because you don't know all of the Chinese that came across. We don't. You know, we may think we do, but we don't. But we do know these Chinese that came across and that are here. And I think it's a good first step of, I guess that's the way I'm looking at it, is these are ones that are out in the open. Well, those are the easiest ones to get. And I think it's a good first step in starting that removal process of these bad actors. And I think that's kind of what's at the heart of this, right, Jason, is they're saying these are people that are here not just as foreign students, but are as kind of arms of the Chinese government. And that's what they're going to claim, and they're going to suck them up and send them back. That's my understanding, right?
That's what I understand, too. And it's kind of interesting to me, is because when's the last time you started hearing about, well, these people are part of the Communist Party? I mean, you know, communism's dead, right? And now we're hearing terms like that, and it's like, okay, I wonder if they're a communist. I wonder if this person over here is a communist. But I mean, we're getting back to our terminology's changing, and you know, it's people are being called what they are. We've been calling them commies for a long time, and you know, that wasn't politically very politically correct, and not that we were worried about it by any means, but. You know, we're hearing that. I mean, here it is right there being tweeted by Rubio that, you know, they're looking at these communists and those that are part of the Communist Party. I just thought that part was interesting.
I think it's interesting, too. And I think the other question I have is, how do they decide who gets to go do what? Because, you know, we got obviously, he wouldn't be saying that, we got some Chinese people associated with the Communist Party. Of course, they're in our colleges and in our tech thing. So who are the low-class communists that they're sending over to places like, Brazil, or making slave labor out of? They're making your stuff there, living in squalid conditions and everything like that. I mean, there's no kind of a equality there, or no kind of, and I'm not really concerned about that as much as I am just, it's strategic placement. Let me put it that way. That's what I'm trying to say. It's a strategic element involved. Yeah. So
when you say that, Tim, as far as the strategy behind it, do you think it's just moving a population closer to the Americas strategically, or what's your thinking behind that?
Well, there's a lot of indications there from what I did a little digging on that particular story about them taking the Chinese students out of the colleges. And if you go back into it, it looks like there's a large percentage of internet crimes and data theft and everything else that results from them being involved in that. I mean, they got boots on the ground. Which is another, several layers less of security as far as computer, as far as data, as far as all those other things go on, which kind of makes sense if you're thinking about it from an asymmetric point of view. I mean, it puts them into, most of your colleges are located in data centers in large populated areas, in power hub areas, and those kinds of things. So having them, and, you know, there's an element there of strategic importance with having them there, I think. And it would make sense that if they're in an area of strategic importance, that they would also, that their philosophy or their political ideologies would align with the communist bloc or with that thought process. So, that's the way I look at it.
Makes total sense. And, you know, we're talking about these, and I don't know a number, maybe y'all know a number of how many of these supposed students are, you know, in the United States, but I pulled up the story because it was in my mind and I had to go back and figure out how long ago it was. You know, if you remember, this is from 2022, the then FBI director had to admit, it was Christopher Wray, had to come out and admit that the FBI knows that there are Chinese police stations throughout the United States, and their intent was to control the growing population of Chinese students, visa workers, and immigrants living in the United States. And so all across the country, and this is something that was in and out of the news cycle very, very quickly, but this is from a Breitbart story from back in November of 2022, and they're talking about the Chinese Communist Party, the Chinese government, sending secret police and setting up areas of operation within the United States to control their citizens that are here. So the Chinese police were inside the United States spying on the everyday activities to keep them in control and in line of what the Chinese Communist Party wants them to do while they're in the United States.
Wow.
I mean, you stop and think about that, you know, with Marco Rubio tweeting out that they're going to get rid of these people. Well, good. Because, I mean, if the Chinese Communist Party is having to send secret police into the United States to monitor the activity and keep in line the Chinese that are here, to me, that's kind of like a supervisor overseeing a worker. They're on a mission, and they're going to make sure that the mission is being completed. I hope that makes sense. I don't know if you guys remember that story or not, but it just makes sense that that's what's really going on.
Wow. I kind of remember hearing something about that. Well, and we've posted stories before about a lot of these Chinese compounds and stuff that are around and different things. As far as the numbers go, I pulled those real quick, and in 2024, there were 277,000 Chinese nationals studying at academic institutions in the United States, and that's the largest group of foreign nationals studying in our country from the world. So there are more Chinese nationals, students here than anywhere else. And if you really want to put a little perspective on it, we have 800 Americans studying over there. But anyway, that's what I came up with.
I hadn't actually been to. I've seen it on movies. You know, you see on some of these movies about Chinatowns and stuff like that here in the United States. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even know. I always thought that, okay, is this real, or is this something that you just see in the movies? But recently, I took a trip and was somewhere, and somebody said something about Chinatown. I'm like, I gotta see Chinatown, and so I went and seen it. And it was just like you see in the movies. I mean, it was basically everybody was Chinese, and it was interesting because there was a Chinese town, Chinatown, and then there was a Japanese town, which wasn't too far away, but it was very, very different. And interesting, and it's like you get down there and it's like when all you're seeing is Chinese people, it kind of it was a different feeling, and you felt like you were in a different country. Very different. That's just for free, but it very interesting.
No doubt.
Wow.
Since Trump's been in, it's not the everyday issue as far as the border and the aliens that are coming across or whatever. But to me, I think this is positive that what this really is just a different way of saying this is just more deportations that are coming. And it's not the wetback that's coming across the southern border, but what they're doing now is shifting that focus into I think it's fair to say they've stabilized the border as much as it's going to be stabilized without having a huge military presence or a physical barrier down there. I think now they're shifting their focus into rooting out those that have in the past been given permission to be here. And I think they're going to revoke that permission and send them packing. And I just say hooray to that. I think it's a good thing.
Well, that's what they've done here in Colorado. We had this this woman that was killed. She was 24-year-old, worked in drug rehab with people. She was hit by a 16-year-old Colombian that was driving 90 miles an hour. No driver's license, no insurance, nothing. Hits this woman down here in Aurora, Colorado. And and gets a slap on the wrist. I mean, nothing. I mean, no jail time, no probation, nothing. And you're talking about, you know, somebody that, you know, just, I mean, killed this person. I mean, murdered him. And they get nothing. I mean, and it's like, how is that? If it was anybody else, if it was my kid or your kid or anybody else, I mean, they'd lock them up and throw away the key. But because they were an illegal from Colombia, they did nothing for them. And this week last week they grabbed them, they arrested them, they took the whole family, and they're deporting them back to Colombia. So,
that was nice that they get their family together.
Exactly. And that's one thing that I remember it being said, well, we're just going to deport the whole family. And well, yeah, they are. We've got a caller on the line. We'll go to the phone lines. Hello, caller.
Yes, this is Edie in North Carolina.
Hey, Edie, how are you?
I'm doing fine considering the situation America's in.
Yep. Yes, ma'am.
I was calling about everybody talking about Rubio and the Chinese communists. Is anybody considering, y'all one time, I have several books actually, about I think a Wiesenthal or Wise or somebody who made the comment that some call it Marxism, but I call it Judaism. So essentially, Judaism and communism is the same thing.
Yes, ma'am.
So why don't you jump on the, all those folks up there doing double duty, you know, in Congress?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you 100%.
Well, just wanted to get it off my mind. Y'all be good.
I appreciate it. I appreciate the call. Good to hear from you. It's been a while. I hope you're doing well.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Jay.
Yes.
Edie makes a great point, and I don't necessarily want to jump back to it, but just because they're a different color or different whatever ethnicity, don't forget, you know, communism is Judaism. Communism is Zionism. It's all the same construct by the usual suspects that are at its base. The mission is the same, and the mission is to destroy God's people. It's to destroy our education system, our family units. That is their long-term goal, is to destroy who we are as far as Israel, to make us forget who we are, because they are doing the bidding of their father, the devil.
Exactly. And I think that that's one of the things that we've been pushing and trying to educate people on for, you know, quite some time now. And it's been a hot topic, and, you know, we use a lot of different names for it, but it's Judaism, and we know who's behind it. I mean, and you know, they've come up with a lot of different names over the years. I mean, you can call it a lot of different things, but absolutely same thing and same MO.
Well, at the end of the day, you can call it whatever you want to call it, but the answer, you know, it starts with a J and ends with an S and rhymes with Jew. So that
10-4 there. Yep.
Yeah. I'll jump back to what we were talking about before Edie called in. You were mentioning, you know, that's what was said. You know, going back to what Tom Homan in that interview said, you know, of when he was being pushed about separating children from their parents that are illegals here in the United States, you know, is he going to deport you know, these parents and leave these kids, you know, parentless. And his answer was, no, we'll just deport the whole family. Well, that's what just happened in Aurora.
Yes.
You know, that's one more example of they're doing what they said they were going to do. And I think that's just that shift and that turn of policy coming out of D.C. And I'm not ringing the bell and saying hooray for Washington, D.C. I'm just saying it sure seems like things are changing. And along those lines, one of the things, and I don't know if y'all caught this or not, I think this is kind of a huge thing as far as a policy shift. June is what the sodomites call Pride Month. They use the month of June to celebrate their sin. And the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, just sent out notice to all of their employees that there will be no Pride activities inside an FBI building or while they're on FBI time, on federal time. I think that's pretty cool. I think that's a huge shift of policy and of mindset.
Yeah, and here you got the FBI team being told that there no pride on company time, and you've got, I mean, how many people even thought that that was possible? I mean, we've got Christians that a year ago were afraid to say that in a church.
Yeah. Yep. Little wins, right? It's just little wins. We can't do it all at once, but it just seems like it's a snowball, just picking up a little bit more and a little bit more as the weeks roll along. And I think it's positive, you know. And one of the things that we have to remember, it may all come to a screeching halt. We don't know what the future holds, but right now it's just it sure seems like we're moving the right direction. And I don't know what other to say other than that. I never saw this coming personally. I didn't. I, you know, usually in the swamp in D.C., you know, everything is equitable and all inclusive unless you're a white Christian. And, you know, there's just these protected statuses. I think this is kind of big that you have the Federal Bureau of Investigation saying you can be whatever you want. It's just not, you're not going to be it here on our time. And I think that's a huge win.
I think it is too. And I think we're seeing more and more and more of that. And that kind of stuff is exciting.
It is.
Very much so. And it just, to me, it sends me reeling still. You know, what are we? It's about to be June. Today's the last day of May. So middle of January. So what are we, 20 weeks into this Trump presidency, something like that? And if we take a moment, if the listeners take a moment and just think about just the stuff that's been talked about on coffee, just all of this stuff that seems like in the span of 4 months, 5 months, think about the preceding 4 years and what's been done in 4 months. It almost makes your head spin of is it possible to live in two opposing worlds so quickly? And that's sure what it seems like, right? As far as the world that we're so far opposite of what we were at the beginning of January. It just is, it's mind-boggling.
Yes, it is.
Well,
go ahead, Tim.
I think it's significant that if I were to describe what's been going on here lately, the word that would jump into my mind, at least, is disclosure.
Yes.
The actions that come out of it are awesome. Some have been really great. There's a few that I have questions about, but disclosure is the one thing that I can see as a positive result about that. And that takes me right back to God shining a light upon these deeds, them being shouted literally from the rooftops right now. I mean, because you've got all these satellite dishes and antennas on the roof, and it's being broadcast up to the whole world. Fluoride's bad. You know, I mean, the list is really, I couldn't cover it all in an hour if I had to, as far as all of the disclosures that are going on. But what disclosure does is it shines, it puts the weight of decision on the individual, because now it's like, okay, you now know these things. Who are you going to serve? You know, what are you going to stand up for? What are you going to put up with? It's no longer a conspiracy theory that, well, you know, I mean, I'm just not satisfied that, no, okay, well, here's the people that you were saying that you would take the word from, that you would take, and they're disclosing this to you. So now you have no excuse any longer as far as to choose you this day, who you'll serve, as far as to getting up there and becoming, you know, getting engaged and getting locked in and those kind of things. So that's just my two cents worth, but there's a lot of disclosure going on.
It sure seems like a time of sifting. I don't know if that's the right way of saying it. You can call it the wheat and chaff or whatever, of where we're being given the opportunity for those that have, you know, eyes to see and ears to hear. Disclosure is what made me think of that, of there's really no excuses now, right? Like it's coming out, and those that choose can listen, learn, and seek the truth. And I just, in my mind, I'm wondering if, I'm not wondering, I know that this is God's intervention in our lives of to bring more back to the fold. And I just wonder what's on the other side of this at the end of this time. You know, is this a time of reprieve to gather more remnant in, and what's coming after this? Hope that makes sense, what I'm trying to say there.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And I think that there is, I mean, and I think that that's what we've been trying to do. We've been trying to push and get more and more truth out there. And there is, what I'm seeing is I'm seeing a lot of stuff that's being brought to light, stuff that's been hidden, something, stuff that's, you know, maybe just, you know, people are feeling comfortable about talking about things that are happening that maybe was always in the back of their minds. And, you know, maybe things that they thought, but they didn't think that they could even talk about before. I mean, to me, it's really exciting. I got a sound clip I want to play real quick. I don't know if now's the time to play it or not, but I'm going to go ahead and play it. This was somebody sent me this, a video, had a conversation with a gentleman a couple days ago from Laramie, and he came down and we were visiting and talking about churches and talking about different things. And he had had a conversation with somebody in his church, and, you know, they basically, it was, you know, we don't talk about politics. We, you know, we stay away from politics. That was, you know, what they kept saying over and over and over. And, you know, he's like, how do you stay away from politics with everything that's happening in the world and in politics right now? How do you stay away from it and call yourself a Christian? And he made some really good points. And then he sent me this. He said, and then I ran across this and was just wanted to share it. And this is a Charlie Kirk interview, and it's just about a minute long. But I'm going to go ahead and play it. Oop. I need to rewind it, and I need to unmute it is what I need to do.
Charlie Kirk is calling out churches. Watch.
You know, Donald Trump's not as pro-life as me. I say, well, has your pastor spoke out regularly against the slaughter of the unborn? Well, no, my pastor doesn't do politics. Oh, so you want Donald Trump to speak out on holy matters when the person you tithe and offer to that you call your home church won't even whisper about it. Got it. Church is a place where you go to be saved and corrected. It is not a place to be told about how your lifestyle is the greatest thing ever. You go there to be reminded that you need a savior and that your life is currently in error. But people don't like that. They say, well, that's not very nice. Well, hold on a second. What exactly are you running here? Is it a church, which is about correction and elevating the divine? Or is it a place where a TED talk occurs with organized parking, above average coffee, and a motivational speech, and good music with nice lights? What exactly are you running there? You see, a church, in its proper context, should be unafraid to go against the culture and not conform to the world, but preach the word.
What do you think of that?
I like that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I
very,
do too.
Very well put. So
I recently, this past week, I had to, I shouldn't say I had to, that sounds, I attended part of a funeral, and the funeral was held in a mega church. There's no other way of saying it. It's one of these proclaim it and claim it, you know, kind of mega churches. And I have never been in it. I've been past it hundreds of times, never had the opportunity or the desire to walk into that building. So I park and I walk in the building and trying to figure out where I need to go. And I walk in and so help me, so help me. I'm not exaggerating. The first thing I see when I walk in, it's not a cross. It's not a mural with, you know, some crosses. It's none of that. It's a Starbucks.
What?
A Starbucks.
Really?
I walk in and yes, and when Charlie Kirk said above average coffee, I had to first off, I don't think Starbucks is above average, but regardless, I walk in and through the main entrance. This isn't a side entrance. It's not like I walked in the wrong door. I walk in through the main entrance and there's a Starbucks with like espresso machines and bottles of syrup. And my OODA loop got messed up. Like, where am I at?
And I'm did I come in the wrong building? Did I come in the wrong door?
Right. And I'm looking around and I can't, and you know, guys, I'm not trying to say that. I'll just say I've been in a lot of churches in my life, and I'm looking around and I can't see anything that resembles a church. Nothing. And you know, you usually there's going to be a bulletin board, maybe some tracks, you know, laying or her out. Some nothing, nothing, zero, nothing. And I'm looking around, and a young lady who was probably, I don't know, 19, 20 years old, because I'm standing in front of this counter of the Starbucks, and she appears kind of out of nowhere and says, "I'm sorry, sir, the coffee shop is closed." and I say, I'm here for a funeral. I'm not here for coffee. And she goes, "Oh, well, follow me." So I do, and I'm the whole time I'm just thinking, like, where am I? And I'm walking down a hallway, and once again, I don't feel like I'm at a church. I feel like I'm walking through a student section at a university or something. That's what it felt like a food court.
That's what it sounds like you're describing. And, if I was just to listen to what you're describing, that's what that's where I would think. You're in the,
like a mall or something.
Student center or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and well, I got to the church, I guess, well, let me back that up. I got to where they have their services, and it looked like a basketball arena. It was just stadium seating, and looks like it would hold, I don't know, 10,000-12,000 people. And she brought me into the side entrance like she was an usher. And there had to be $250,000 worth of production equipment up on that stage. I mean, it was something to behold. And I went and sat. I can't tell you what the minister or whatever they call them said, because I was sitting in the seating just thinking, what is this? I'm kind of running off the mouth, but that was kind of my experience to go along with what I drove away from that day thinking, this is a production. This is a country club. This is whatever. This is a lot of things, but it ain't church. It's not church as defined in scripture. I walked around that building before I left just a little bit, and I couldn't find anything visible that remotely related to fellowshipping with the Almighty God. The story, the salvation story, of our Lord. There was nothing. Not remotely. Other than it looked like they had a pretty awesome coffee set up. I can't really, and what would make a probably awesome rock concert up on stage. I don't know what to say. I mean, I was just, I will tell you, I got back in my truck and I drove off and my mind was racing and I thought, this is the state of the modern so-called Christian church. This is, you are here for a show. And that's about it. And I don't know. I mean, you guys could to lump on there if you want to, but that was just my experience this week.
Wow. That sounds like an experience. That's for sure.
Yeah.
It strikes me as interesting that, you know, the Bible, and I don't have an address, but the Bible talks about, Christ, you know, as being a person of, you know, common means, and that, you know, there was nothing during his earthly walk that would recommend him as being, you know, some super. He basically dressed simply, lived simply, and those sort of things. It was the message that he brought that was awesome, and the things that he did. And I think it's always struck me as funny with these mega churches. You know, they got to have all the glory and all the glitz and everything else, and they even align themselves with these companies and these places that are what come to mind when you're talking about the Starbucks is Jason and I were I think we were in Tennessee one time and we were jonesing pretty hard for a cup of coffee in the morning and nothing was open, and we drove around town all over. You remember that, Jason?
Yeah.
The only place we could find open was like a Starbucks, and we were like, I don't know if I want to go in there and get coffee or not, you know. So you're just doing this whole thing, but I mean,
well, that's what I'm sitting here thinking. It's like, I can't get anybody to show up for church. So maybe that's what I needed is a coffee shop or something like that. Maybe that's what draws people in. You can't get anybody to show up for church. So you got to get on the radio.
I got more to that, though. I left off when I was telling my story, because I stood there for probably 60 seconds before the little blue-haired girl came and asked me or told me that the coffee shop was closed. I was standing there, and I realized this isn't like a complimentary, like where they're getting people in. Like, you got to buy this stuff. And it was appropriately priced, like Starbucks was priced. I mean, it was $5-6 for a cup of coffee. So I don't know. I just thought that was interesting. And to go along with what you were saying, Tim, there's a sign right there kind of on the counter that says Proudly Brewing Starbucks. Proudly Brewing. And I just thought, I wonder, has anyone told them that, hey, Starbucks hates Christians?
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
You know, like, why would you be proud of this? But anyways, I just, yeah.
Well, I got invited to a church down in Denver not too long ago, and somebody gave me a couple of brochures and really wanted me to come bring the family, come down there, and it was for Good Times, and I'm like, well, Good Times, and it's like, I'm like, okay, what do you mean? It's good. You need to come down on Good Times Day, and I'm like, okay, what's Good Times Day? Well, we bring in the Good Times, and Good Times comes in and caters. And so they bring a hamburger shop in, and I guess they got like a food truck or something. I don't know what it is, but they come in and you get the food, and they have Good Times Days, and then they have like Dairy Queen Day, and I mean all these different kind of stuff. And they bring these restaurants in and have them cater food to them. And I don't know. I guess it was kind of like something that I'd never heard of, but I'm not around some of those big churches very often. Interesting.
Whole thing reminds me of when Christ braided up a cord and drove them all out of the temple and said, don't make my Father's house a house of merchandise. You know, I mean, It's like that. I'm just a quick, whatever off the cuff.
I'm glad you said that, because those were some of my thoughts as I was driving out of the parking lot, of fighting the urge of going back in and at least attempting to overturn that coffee bar. This is the equivalent of the money changers, right, of a place of commerce. There's nothing new under the sun. They have taken what supposedly is a consecrated temple, a church, right, and they've just turned it into a place of commerce. They're proudly serving Starbucks. And it doesn't say, I didn't find a sign anywhere in the building that said they're proudly serving our Lord God Almighty.
Yeah.
But I did find a sign that says they're proudly serving Starbucks. And I think that is a good commentary in the state of the church that it is.
Well, and it's a play on words too. You think about serving, it's like it can be two ways. So who's serving who?
Yeah, really. Absolutely. Yep. There's a whole bunch of wrong there.
No doubt. Anyways, I don't know how we got off on that. I apologize, but it was something that happened to me. I think we were talking about Charlie Kirk. I apologize.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought it was just interesting. That's the thing. It's like, like what he said in there, he said on the abortion issue, it's like, so many of these churches have just even refused to take a stand on that.
Well, yeah, and if you think about it, there's some real tenets, if you want to call that, or I would call them foundational principles, and our young or our children are one of them. They're a heritage under the Lord, and the fact that this, and I'm really tired of this whole homosexual issue. You know, it's like, well, we don't really want to talk about that. And I'm like, we're right. It shouldn't exist. It shouldn't be anywhere around. That's just biblical. So you can't serve two masters. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things there that goes on. And we just need some people to stand up and tell it the way it is. God hates it.
It's like the message that was played at church last week by Colonel Moore. I think about we are supposed to be salt, and like Colonel Moore discussed in that sermon, a lot of that has to do with preservation. And I know personally what I'm taking out of what you're saying, Tim, is the preservation of the truth, the real truth, the gospel truth. We've lost our saltiness because we have not, from the pulpits, preserved that truth and preached that truth. And I think it's by design. It's been successful. That doesn't eliminate the truth. The truth will stand for all time. And kind of going along with what we're talking about with what's coming out of D.C. and the things that are being said there, I think our people especially should be emboldened more than ever to take up that cause of speaking against homosexuality, speaking against abortion, speaking against those things that we know are abominations to God, because now's the time. We have to get back to being salty. And, some of us, that's never really gone away. But as far as the world is concerned, I think it's time for some salty men to speak up.
Well, and going along the line of salt, another thought that occurs is salt is wonderful for preservation, but it also has healing and antiseptic qualities. You put it in a wound, but it causes upset and pain if you have a wound. You put salt in it, the old thing. It's like, you're rubbing salt in but if you think about it, there's a lot of the salt analogy is a very good one. I mean, there's all kinds of benefit from that entire situation.
Amen.
Well, and we've talked about voting with your dollars and spending money on different places. I seen the U.S. government just canceled a $766 million contract with Moderna, and they pulled the plug on that. And $766 million, that's an awful lot of money. And it was a contract to develop a vaccine for the H5N1 bird flu, because they thought that there might be an outbreak of some new bird flu virus. They had a contract to build, to manufacture this vaccine, to develop this vaccine, and finally pulled the truck, the plug on it. And it's just interesting how they spend, you know, you spend $1 billion, basically, you know, $750 million on developing a vaccine for something that we haven't had an outbreak on. And how many, much of the time it's like, you know, you spend $1 billion on something and you just do that just in case someday that there's this outbreak. It seems like you get the vaccine, they get the vaccine, they spend all this money, they get it manufactured and all that kind of stuff, and then all of a sudden that there's an outbreak, a new crisis, and now we can put the vaccine to work.
I'm a simple man, Jason.
Yeah.
I don't know about developing vaccines. I know about growing potatoes. I don't know about developing vaccines, but how can you develop a vaccine on a strain of bird flu that hasn't happened yet?
Exactly.
Unless you're getting it at both ends. If you're engineering it, then you can come up with a vaccination for it. I don't know. That was just it. In reading over that news story, it seems to me what I hope is that we pulled the plug to, first off, blacken the eye a little more of Big Pharma, but secondly, because we're paying for something that's not going to be effective because we don't know if there's even going to be this new strain of bird flu. It's just hypothetical, and it's just money that's going into the pockets of people who don't need any more money. So I'm glad they did it. I think it's one more example, you know, the stuff that's been going on in the last couple of weeks that's coming out of the Health and Human Services with RFK Jr. and Trump. I mean, they're really cutting purse strings and throwing punches at Big Pharma. That's a dangerous proposition in the world.
It is. It is very dangerous. And it's exciting because, I mean, they're not afraid to call a spade right now. And you know, they're exposing a lot of this stuff and talking about you know, the dangers of some of these vaccinations and stuff like that. I mean, it is, you know, before when, you know, you had to be in a position like that, you had to be 100% pro for Big Pharma. And you're seeing that change. Yeah. And there's a shift on that front as well. So that's interesting.
Along those lines, it's something that just came out. I think it was from a couple of days ago, the 28th, maybe 2 or 3 days ago. I don't know if y'all caught this or not, but same guy, RFK Jr., HHS secretary, he announced that the clot shot, the COVID shot, has been pulled from the CDC schedule for children, pregnant women, and some other classes of people. And it would be nice to say it's just getting pulled, but man, it's, you eat an elephant one bite at a time, and it's just one little more bite, one little more bite, one little more bite. It sure seems like it's every day they're coming out with just one more example of dismantling the machine. That's what it seems like to me.
Yeah, well, and they're empowering people to discern what's going on, and I think it's interesting that to speak out. We have a lot of, you know, it's interesting. They have like 5 or 6 or 10 or however many talking heads they have out there that were carrying on about the jab being great and everything. But there's a whole slew of them out there now that are saying, okay, the empirical evidence is in. the best way. I watched a congressional hearing the other day, and he said the best way to tell what's going on is through autopsy. And what we're finding out is that these people died from the jab. You know, I mean, that's there's no other way to put it. That's what it is. This issue brings up the aspect of the fact that responsibility. Who's responsible for this damage? Who's responsible for this reckless, you know, endangering of human life over these crazy things? And of course, you know, they were given this waiver of liability, but. You know, sometimes the fact that, if they don't like the rules, they just change them. We don't always like that. We talk that down a lot of it. But sometimes it's not such a bad thing if it works against them. You know, so you know, we gave you your immunity. We can sure take it away. So, you know. And so I think there's a lot of interesting things on the horizon that are very interesting as far as what's going on, what's happening, who the players are. And they're definitely these large. One of the other things that interested me over this deal of Moderna, and as I was reading an article on H5N1, is that what it is? I think the bird flu, but they're also having a pretty big infusion of it into cows. It's bird flu, but, you know, it's affecting cows. What if it jumps in there? And I think we're seeing this. It, to me, it's a very defined battle line against the livestock producers of our country right now. I mean, we're seeing they want to destroy the chickens. They want to destroy the cows. They want to, you know, all these animals. And then they want to, you know, give us some kind of lab-grown meat or some kind of, you know, Soylent Green. You know, I don't know. It's like, yeah, wow. So, anyways, it just leaves you wondering what's next. But they're getting the light shone on them.
Yeah, that's for sure. What is going on with that battle over the lab-grown meat right now? I mean, I've heard that. Things there are heating up. Tim, you know what's that happening that with that?
Oh, I haven't heard for sure, but there's a bill right now laying on Greg Abbott's desk that will ban cell cultured proteins in Texas. Montana, Indiana, Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, and Nebraska have already enacted, you know, bans like that. Because they're obviously these are, you know, beef producing states, and it's like they're trying to come in and bring that stuff in there. I thought it was interesting. The one from Texas basically says that, well, you can go ahead and do bioreactors and stuff in laboratories for, you know, research purposes, but you cannot, and you have to realize they can kind of say what they do. They pay for this schooling, right? So they're saying you can't use it as a means of researching ways to make it cheaper to sell or for human consumption. So I think that bill number is SB 261 in Texas, but there's just, and again, we don't even need all these rules that say it can't be. All you got to do is vote it out with your pocketbook. You know, refuse to buy it. I mean, let's make them label it and let's let it rot on the shelf. You know, I mean, it's like if it's these people are a bunch of whores. If it's not financially attractive or whatever, odds are it's going to, you know, dry up and blow away.
It's interesting. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. I mean, it's like, okay, so they're going to ban it. What are they going to have, like, underground labs producing lab-grown meat? I mean, you think about it. It's kind of funny. Yeah. What are these granola heads going to do? well, I mean, the stuff, if you look at it, I mean, you break it down, the stuff's absolutely horrible for you. I mean, and it's like, I mean, most of the time anything that comes out of a lab is, but you're not supposed to eat that crap. That's that stuff's a bunch of garbage. It reminds me, and this is just for free, but it was this was several years ago. I was in Snowville, Utah, sitting at there's a cafe there called Molly's Diner. And it's a hole in the wall. They got it's right off of Interstate 84, but it's basically they got a post office and two truck stops and two restaurants on a four-way intersection. And I was sitting there at Molly's, and these people came in and they sat down there and they're looking at the menu up and down, up and down. And this is ranch country. I mean, it's it's filled with local ranchers and farmers. These people come in and you could tell that they were just must have been people that were passing through, and they're looking up and down the menu and this and that. And they call the waitress over and says, well, like, do you have a plant-based menu? And the lady looks at him and is like, what? And, is this everything that you have? And it's like, what do you have that's plant-based? And the lady's like, do you want a salad? And they're like, no, we want some, plant-based protein. And she's like, we've got beef. And they were just, and they got up and they walked out and they left the restaurant. It was comical. Wow. It was really funny. But it was something to see. And if I hadn't seen it for myself, I don't know if I would have believed that. It's like, and these people, they were serious and they were upset and they did not understand why there was not they didn't have another plant-based. That's the kind of place that you don't go in and you don't ask for a gluten-free bun or anything like that. It's what it is.
Jason, there is no better plant-based protein than beef.
I agree, 100%. The original plant-based protein.
The original, absolutely. So,
full output. Go ahead.
Yes. No. I think I'm proud to say what I'm about to say. I don't know a vegetarian or a vegan person, so I don't know the answer to this, and I'm not sure you guys do either. But would a vegetarian or a vegan tree hugger would they eat lab grown meat?
My thought is that they shouldn't, because it's actually cell cultured meats made in those bioreactors, and they use harvested animal cells. To create their base. So it's not a plant, I guess would be the right word for it. I mean, the beginning of it, they're using God's dirt. So it's like,
I don't know what they would. I don't know what kind of people eat that, because I really don't know anybody that eats that kind of stuff. So I don't know what if a vegetarian would eat it, or if it's somebody, I don't even know why, but yeah, no, that's a good question. I never thought about that. Who actually eats this stuff, and what do they call themselves? I don't know.
Losers.
Yes.
I think it must appeal to these, PETA, or, these people who are so sure that there's some kind of major cruelty I think a lot of that's soft-headed as far as the farming goes and that kind of angle of ranching goes, because it's like, well, that's my opinion, but it's like the thought of killing an animal is just reminds me of something Grandpa would say, you just haven't been hungry enough yet. So
that's right.
But anyway.
Well, We'll go down to you, Will, and I was just going to ask you this question. So I seen in the news in Texas that this House passed this bill on to legalize short-barreled firearms. And basically from – I I'm trying to understand how this works, but basically they're saying like sawed-off shotguns are going to be legal in the state of Texas. Are they not legal? Are they legal? Is it, I mean, because basically short barreled rifles and short barreled shotguns are an NFA item. And so I don't think that that's going to change. What, how would you describe what is happening on that?
Yeah. In my opinion, what this is an effort, by the Texas lawmakers to kind of clean up their prohibited weapons law.
Okay.
And in the penal code of Texas, short-barreled shotguns or short-barreled rifles are considered to be a prohibited weapon.
So Ken, if you go through the process just like a suppressor or something like that, if you go through the process and get, you know, your tax stamp and stuff like that, does it make it legal or is it just?
Yes.
Oh, it does. Yes. Okay.
It does. So it doesn't preclude if you're doing the NSA process. It doesn't exclude. So if you're going through the $200 tax stamp, the background check that the feds required, all of that, it's fine. You can have a short-barreled rifle or a short-barreled shotgun. Really what this is, I think the reason they're cleaning it up is it is a throwback from a bygone era. It's really going back to Bonnie and Clyde. That's how long it has been on the books.
Okay.
You had these gangsters that were cutting down the barrels of, like, Browning automatic rifles and running around and wreaking havoc, you know, all through the Midwest and Texas. And that's when it went on the books. And I think they're just taking it off, saying it's an out of date law that shouldn't be there. So I don't think it changes anything as far as Texas is concerned, as much as it just kind of cleans it up and takes some of the question mark off the sentence, if that makes sense. That, you know, if I go through the feds, am I still committing a law or breaking the law in Texas? So I think they're just taking that away so it's more clear. And I hope I was clear in that explanation. I don't know if I was or not.
So. Yeah, because it was kind of confusing the way that they had everything worded in there. It's like, okay, yeah, this makes sense. This does not make sense. You read just the headlines and before you finish the article, it makes it sound like, oh yeah, if you want to buy a sawed-off shotgun, you can just go down to Texas and pick one up at the local pawn shop, really didn't think that was going to be the case.
Yeah, that is it's not the case. It's the Texas will say that all the federal statutes still apply. And, you know, you're going to have to follow those processes in order to basically what happens. Maybe this is the easiest way of saying it is if you have a short barreled rifle and you haven't gone through the NFA process as it stands now, Texas will not seek charges against you, but the Fed still will.
Gotcha. OK.
Right.
Yeah.
That is how I see it. There's nothing in the law. There's no provision in this of there isn't a new law that's being created. They added to nothing as far as the penal code is 4605 in the state of Texas that talks about weapons or prohibited weapons. They didn't say anything that you're immune from federal law, that the state is saying that, you know, this is the law of the state of Texas. They didn't say that. They just removed it from their prohibited weapons list.
Gotcha.
All of the federal statutes still apply. Yeah.
So, that makes a lot of sense, actually. I think that they've been doing that in a couple other states, too. I know Idaho's been making some changes to their codes and stuff like that. And Montana, Wyoming, a lot of different stuff's happening. And it's kind of like what happened a couple years ago. See, it used to be in Colorado that a switchblade was illegal if you had a two-edged knife, if it was sharp on both sides. That was considered a dagger. That was illegal. There was butterfly knives were illegal. Throwing stars were illegal. Throwing knives were very illegal. A lot of different stuff. And they went back in and changed that, which I didn't even know about it. And one day I walked into the sporting goods store, local sporting goods stores, and they had a whole display case full of switchblades. And it was like, oh, can I see that? That was pretty cool. It used to be if you wanted one of those, we would my last switchblade, my uncle bought me, and he was from Minnesota, but he picked it up in Tennessee. And he called me one day when he was down in Tennessee. He's like, do you know that switchblades are legal in Tennessee? And I said, no, I didn't. And he's like, well, I didn't either. He's like, I got me one and I got you one. He got me a really nice Benchmade switchblade down there. I was really happy with. There was a lot of states that, you know, that was something that was illegal to carry. I don't know. I think it was illegal to have it in your car. I'm not sure. But since then, all that stuff has changed. So that's I don't know. I think that there's probably, I'm just sure that there's some states that's still illegal. But I've been surprised at how many states that I've heard about where that is that they're perfectly legal now.
There's a movement, and it is in a bunch of states. And the one that I'll kind of just bring out real quick, like here in Texas, under prohibited weapons, you still can't have a blackjack or a sap, right? So a piece of leather with some lead on the end of it. Can't carry that, but I can carry like a 2-inch piece of iron pipe, and that's perfectly fine. Our tire tool, right. I mean, those things are, you know, our short baseball bat, you know, all of those things are fine. But if I take a piece of leather and put a piece of lead on it, that is a felony. And I think that, over time that you will see more and more of that get cleaned up, that maybe some common sense coming into our weapons law, which once again, I think is a great thing. I think it's a great thing.
Well, and up until a couple of years ago, the Bowie knife was illegal in the state of Texas, correct?
Correct. And that is correct. And that is the state knife of Texas was illegal. You couldn't carry one because of the drop point on the end of it being able to be sharpened at the end, that we had the same law that, you know, you couldn't have a double-edged knife that could be sharpened. And, you know, I remember hearing guys talk about, well, what you do is you buy a Bowie knife and you dull out that drop point, right? So that it's not sharpened on both sides. And that was the kind of legal hoops that guys were trying to, and I'm talking about like reenactors that were going to the Alamo to, you know, reenact the Alamo. They were not able to carry a Bowie knife that was sharpened on both sides because they would have been breaking the law if they did so. So, yeah, that was the kind of joke of the state knife of Texas is the Bowie knife. But by golly, if you wear one and open, the state of Texas is going to put you in jail for wearing the state knife. So, yeah, that got cleaned up, though, thank goodness.
That's a good thing. Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah. For sure.
So, several years ago, before the concealed weapon, you know, scenarios have come up now and constitutional carry and everything, I was talking to a guy I knew in law enforcement. We were talking about automatic knives and some other things, or, you know, I said, so if you carry in one of those, it's illegal. And he's like, well, he goes, it's an add-on charge, you know, and I was like, it's a what? And he goes, if you get, you know, if you're doing something highly illegal and we arrest you and you have that, that's an add-on charge. He goes, we don't really go out of our way to chase you down for that. I mean, that's not like we're out there looking to see who's carrying an automatic knife in the pocket as a concealed weapon or something. But he said it gives us an add-on if we run into some other things. So, and these are the mental gymnastics that this system has to go through. I assume. It's like,
yeah. It's stackable charges is how I've heard it described. Tim, is they're only there to stack charges. That's why they exist. And one of the ones that just drives me crazy here in Texas is under that same prohibited weapon charge, on our misdemeanor scale, you know, you have class A, class B, class C misdemeanors depending on the severity. Driving while intoxicated is a class B misdemeanor for your first offense. So if you're driving while intoxicated and you get popped by a state trooper or whatever for that charge, and you're lawfully carrying a gun, or if it's just in your car, then you now have committed a felony. Because if you're carrying the gun or have it about your person and you're in the commission of a class B misdemeanor or above, then you've committed a felony. Does any of that make sense? Does that make sense what I said? Yeah. And that is to me kind of like, okay, so I can get drunk in my house and everything is good. And vehicles have been ruled by the United States Supreme Court to be an extension of your home. So if I'm drunk in my car and that's where my gun is, that's just like having a gun in my house, but I'll get charged with a felony. And that just makes no sense. Yeah, it's just a stackable charge. And the reason why they do that is it's a stackable charge so the prosecutor can come later. And they know there was no intent to use that gun as a weapon in a crime or anything like that. They come and say, hey, here's what we're going to do. You plead guilty to that DWI and we'll drop this gun charge. And, you know, we'll drop the felony against you. It's just a stackable charge to be used by the prosecution later. And that drives me. I'm sure he knows what's going through my mind right now.
I know.
It's just a bunch of problems.
Yeah.
It just is crazy. So don't do that, people. If you're out there and you're listening to us, just don't.
Yep.
Don't do that.
Yep.
No one likes that.
Exactly. What about, looking at the clock, we're going to have to move on. What is this? I've been hearing about these screw worms threatening Texas cattle. What does anybody know anything about that? What is this? I mean, I'd never heard of a screw worm until just recently, but I've seen several things that it's just popped up on. New worm from Mexico? Is that where it came from?
I don't know where it originated from, but I know that we've had to do this before as far as the country's concerned. I think it's going back in the 1950s or 60s or something like that.
Okay.
My understanding is it's a parasitic maggot, and they bore into the flesh of cows or other animals. They hatch their flies, and then the cycle continues, and the flies go and do the same thing over and over on especially cattle. And it is my understanding is contagious. I don't know if that's the right word, but prolific. It's a highly prolific fly. And right now, and actually when I found out about this, I contacted a veterinarian friend of mine here in Texas, and they said it's about 700 miles from the border of Texas right now is where they have it contained. So it's in the interior of Mexico. And the Trump administration has halted all imports of cattle into the United States. And kind of, I know we're getting close to talking about Prepper Tip of the Week. We talked about coffee last week. I'm going to talk about beef a little bit this week because it's already shaping up as, you know, of being a lean summer and going into the fall as far as supply of beef into the system here in the United States. Well, this is going to shorten it even more because we're not going to see any beef coming from south of the border coming into the United States for processing because of this screw worm, this screw fly or whatever they want to call it. And they're doing everything they can to try to contain the outbreak there in Mexico. I know the United States has sent some folks down, is what I was being told, to try to assist with that. And weird enough,
what are they treating it with? Do you have any idea? I mean,
I was just about to say that.
Okay.
I got an education on it that there is no real treatment, like a topical treatment or an intravenous treatment, or it's not like giving ivermectin or something to a cow that knocks it's not like a dewormer, in other words. So what I was told yesterday was Texas A&M here in Texas actually has a supply of sterilized screwworm larva that's been like in stasis. I don't know if it's frozen or what, because they've done this before. And the only way to really knock this out is to disrupt the reproductive cycle. So what they do is introduce these sterilized flies into the affected area, and they're unable to lay new eggs. So the reproductive cycle gets halted, and no new eggs get laid. Kind of interesting.
And they eat the worms? Is that what they do?
No, they don't eat the worms. They actually, these are female flies that the males mate with, but they're unable to lay fertilized larvae, and that disrupts the life cycle. I guess the life cycle of these things is short, you know, within a few days, six, seven, 8 days, whatever. And I guess what I was told back in the 1950s, 1960s, this is actually how they stopped the outbreak, was doing this. And, you know, I'll make a joke because I always like laughing, is you guys tell me exactly how do you, like, neuter or spay a fly?
I was just going to ask you that. That was my next question.
I have no clue, but that takes a steady hand and good eyesight, and I'm not sure I have either one of those, so... it's a real thing, and the takeaway for me is just the supply of beef coming into the market was already going to be short this year, and it looks like this is going to shorten it even more.
Well, that's what I've been looking at, the prices of beef this last week, and it's like, number one, is what I noticed is there was a lot of places that were just completely sold out. Ordering places that you could normally order an eighth, a quarter, a half, a whole beef out and not taking any orders. And there was a bunch of them. And I just was, checking because I wanted to look at, you know, to see what the beef prices were doing. Got some beef there at the ranch and we've been feeding them out. And man, cows are expensive, feed's expensive. And I'm trying to figure out, it's like, man, what did these things are going to be worth a lot of money. And it is, I think that the shortage is already, I think it's already here.
Yeah. Well, and going back to the screwworm thing too, the other reason that we haven't heard of up north is the freezing cycles. They can't survive our frost.
Ah, makes sense.
It breaks the cycle. They can't. That's why we're not familiar with them up here, is they never survive the winter, so there's no continuation of the breeding cycle.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Makes total sense. I was going to talk about, you know, beef cattle, Jason, just for a second. The auctions here, you know, you got pairs, mamas and calves, this past week, they're going for about $4,000 at auction right now. I mean, it's really, the price is really starting to tick up around us. I don't know if you've paid any attention to what's going on around you, if it's higher or lower, but
it's higher. It's definitely higher, but it's,
this is high for us. I mean, this is, I know some of the guys I was talking to, they're talking about, you know, around $4 a pound at auction, and that's high for us down here, and that's going to get passed on. So,
yes, it is indeed, and I don't see it getting any cheaper anytime soon. That's for sure. Especially now that we're talking about this and the, you know, the beef shortage and stuff like that, and we've already stopped the import of beef from a couple other countries.
Yep.
So,
yep.
Yeah, it's definitely going to, I think it's just going to keep going up and up and up. And that's what I like about being able to raise our own. You know, we raise our own beef. Richard's got one he's raising. I know a lot of people that are, raising, raise one or two steers, feed them out, and, get them butchered. And it's just nice. I mean, it's expensive, but it's, in the long run, it does save money. You know what you're eating. You put good stuff into it. You're going to get some good stuff out of it. I don't like just going to the store and just buying whatever's on the market. You just don't know what you're getting. It's nice when you can go over to the deep freeze and open it up and, figure out what you're going to have and what you're going to cook. So, I don't know. I think it's a good thing.
Yeah. Peace of mind.
Well, it's certainly
going to change some operating principles. And I've looked at, and I'm not a broker or anything like that, but if you look at live cattle futures and the five-year averages and the like, the difference in price is not huge. We're talking five-year average is like $150, $160. Right now they're bringing $215, but where the price really jumps is if you look at the boxed beef cutout, obviously the stuff going to the store, it's really jumping. I mean, it's going from like, $260, $270 on the five-year average up to like $370. So that's huge.
Yeah.
So there's a whole bunch of that kind of stuff going on it's going to get dicey. And just for FYI, I don't think our ranchers are making a lot of carryovers are going to make a lot of money on. But some of this new stuff, I mean, feed's gone up, replacement heifers have gone up. These are all factored in. These are all overhead. So I don't know. I mean, I actually hope they can make some money. I'm not saying anything bad about that. I'm just saying, but I actually worry about whether the margins have really changed much for them. So,
people need to get to know their farmers too. I mean, and know your farmer, know where your food comes from, and you can always, most places you can find some locally grown beef, work out a deal with somebody with a farmer rancher. There's places that are popping up all over the place, and that is exciting, and I'm happy to see that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But
get yourself a better deal and make him some money.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Okay, we're going to move on to prepper tip of the week. Bug out bags, get home bags. What are you carrying in your vehicle? What, when, why, and where? We've heard a lot of people talk about, my go bag, my bug out bag, this and that. What do you got? And it was a question. I had somebody that brought it up to me this week. I talked with Will a little bit about it, and it's I figured, everybody's got their own ideas and everything like that. But a couple things that we were talking about, common sense and logic, it goes a long way, I think, when it's putting together your bug out bag. What are you carrying? What do you got in your vehicle? I'll turn it over to you, Will. What do you want to start with?
One of the things that I guess is, bug out bag, the idea of, to me, that means you're leaving your homestead or your home and going somewhere else. And I guess right off the bat, my question would be, why? Is that the right mindset? And there's obviously going to be situations if you're living in an apartment complex or something like that. You're going to have a secondary location you're moving to that you think is more secure for whatever the reason may be. That's one thing. For me, on a personal level, what I have is a get home bag, because that's going to be my home base, and I'm not in a situation where I live in a a big population center. I live in a small town. So to me, I'm getting home to my family because that is where I'm going to make my stand. So getting home and bugging out, same idea, maybe a different mindset. So I think right from the get-go, what you need to decide is what you're really what are you going to do with this bag, you know, and the kit gets built off of there. And one of the things I know I brought up to you, Jason, this week is like in your vehicle, in your truck, you know, there are those that commute, and whatever the calamity may be, you know, EMP, just fill in the blank of whatever it is. Think about what you wear every day. You know, if you're going to the office, you're going to the plant, you're going to work or whatever. What if you got to get home and maybe you live 20, 30 minutes away? What's the footwear you're wearing? Are you carrying extra socks? Are you carrying comfortable shoes, you know, hiking boots or tennis shoes that you're going to be able to slip on and make that hike? So to me, Jason, I think that's just a good place to start real fast is what are you really wanting to do? You know, and if you do have a bug out bag, where are you bugging out to? You know, is it a privately owned piece of land? Is it a family piece of land that, you know, other people are going to meet you at? Or are you just planning on going into the hills, into a national forest where you're probably going to be joined by a lot of other people who have that plan too? So I think that's a good place to start.
I think so too. And I think that's one of the things of, I hear a lot of people talking about, you know, my bug out bag, and I'm headed to the mountains. You know, around here, we're at the foothills of the Rockies, and I hear it all the time is we're heading to the mountains. We're heading here to Red Feather. We're going this place. And it's like, yeah, you and how many other thousands of people, are going to go to the same place. And well, we're going to go up there and we're going to go shoot deer and elk and that's survive off the land. And it's like, you and everybody else, a lot of times I think that it's, you know, the better state of mind is it, and you need to make an effort or a conscious effort to decide, am I better off bugging out or am I better off sheltering in place? And I think that that's one of the things that people need to think about is a lot of times in a lot of situations, you're going to be way better off sheltering in place and being able to use the resources that you have available in your house, in your garage, in your shop, with your neighbors, stuff like that.
Yeah.
I think it's very important. Like you said, I've had a pack that, and okay, it wasn't a bug out bag, but it was my going to the mountains bag. And I took off on a hike up to Estes Park and went on it. It was on a trail, going to hike up to a lake. And I had this pack, and I had everything that you can imagine. And it was not a comfortable pack. I noticed that a couple miles into it, that this thing is really uncomfortable. And it was a military surplus pack, and it was big, and it had all these compartments, and I thought it was comfortable, but it was like, oh my goodness, and I had way too much weight in it. And a couple miles into it, I'm getting off the trail, and I'm stashing stuff, trying to figure out where how I can find it when I'm on my way back down, and I'm unloading it, making it lighter and making it lighter. And my back was hurting, and it was a struggle. And once you get one of those kinks in your back and you've got a pack on and you're trying to, you know, keep going miles after miles after miles, it just becomes more difficult and more difficult, and you start hurting more and more and more, and pretty soon it's a bad deal. I mean, it's to the point where I got to the point where all I cared about was water and some food and nothing else. You know, I mean, I had a Leatherman on my, and nothing else mattered. I didn't care. I was not going to, you know, take all that extra. I was prepared for everything. I was prepared for the zombie apocalypse in that backpack. And there's no way I could have made it to the top of that mountain and back with it in my current condition. And I think that's what, you know, people need to think about that. You know, everybody says, well, we, you know, when it hits the fan, I'm going to be able to do this and I'm going to be able to do that. No, you're not. If you're not in shape now, you're not going to be in shape immediately when you need to be. And I think that,
right.
You know, having that, that bag, but okay. Yeah. You might have everything in it, but you need to be able to think about what you can get out of that bag. Do you really need all that stuff? Are you just carrying around a bunch of dead weight? I mean, in the summertime when you're going, you know, across Texas or across Wyoming, you need water. If you had to get out of your car, if your vehicle stopped, you've got to think about, hydration. That is huge, and that is going to be number one for your survival, in my opinion. And like you said, if I'm wearing my cowboy boots and I'm walking, driving across Wyoming, and my car breaks down, and I have to get out, my feet are going to be killing me in 5 miles if I'm wearing my cowboy boots walking along the side of the road. Tennis shoes, a pair of running shoes that are not a brand new pair, but something that I've already broke in and used. And you know how it is when you get a new pair of shoes and you get in there, sometimes they give you blisters because they don't fit quite right. You got to break them in. Having a broken pair of shoes would be huge and life-changing.
I just want to say that real fast. It's as simple as when you get ready to buy a new pair of shoes, don't donate or throw your old pair away. Throw them behind the truck or behind the seat of the truck. Forget that they're there until you need to use them. It's making a deposit in your prep bank of, you know, like you said, Jason, it just may be breaking down because you got a bad fuel pump or something. Well, now you don't have to walk 2 or 3 miles in your cowboy boots. You could be comfortable while you walk. It's just little mindset changes like that. And real quick, I know we're running out of time, but I just want to talk about the bug out thing real fast. Whatever your bug out location is, I want people to live in reality. You know, a lot of times we get caught up in the Hollywood idea of the zombie apocalypse and the road, and I'm going to strap on my bag and I'm going to bug out. Well, before that time comes, whatever that hike looks like, you know, if you're planning on following the railroad tracks or the power lines to whatever your secret squirrel location is, do it without your pack and do it like in August and take that hike. And once you take that hike, if you successfully make it, now walk back. And the next time you go, put your pack on. And I think we would be surprised that we may be kidding ourselves a lot that this is a good practical idea. I advocate people, if you're going to bug out, great. Have your plan and execute your plan before it's time for execution. Practice it. You know, build up your endurance. Build up the strength that would be needed to make that trek. Because the really important thing is if it hits the fan, and we're going to have to do this, you're not taking into account all of the external stressors that are going to be different than practice. So you're going to be worried about people watching, people interfering with your trek, you know, people trying to steal yourself, all of these things. You know, if you're bringing your family with you, now you're having to have overwatch for them. All of the external stressors that go along with this, that's just going to be more taxing physically to you. You've got to take that into account, and you have to practice it before it happens. Before the flag goes up, you need to have done that. And a lot of times we rely on kit, we rely on gear, and we think we have it, we're going to be safe. But if you don't know how to use that stuff, if you haven't used that stuff, when it happens is not the time to learn. It's also not the time to learn that you're not physically able to do the things that you have imagined that you could do. You need to practice those things.
Very good point. Yep. I think that was very well said. And I think we need to talk about it in the future. Maybe next week we'll talk about, you know, navigation. You get out, you get off, yes, off the road and stuff like that. There's a lot of people that magically in their minds, they think that they know how to get from point A to point B. And I've seen a lot of people that have got lost. As soon as they get away from a road or highway or power line or whatever it is, whatever their markers are, and I think that's something that we need to talk about in the future. But we are out of time, and men, I want to say thank you for being here this morning, and folks, thanks for being here. Just continue on. Join us for church tomorrow. Go to www.scriptures4america.org, sfaw.org. We've got a new Richard's going to have a scriptural review of the news. We've got some new timeless pulpit truth messages that we're going to continue on with that I'm excited about. And also, we're just continuing to get a lot of feedback on the Simon Roche interview with the Sidelanders from South Africa. Fantastic interview that we had this last week. That is at the website www.scriptures4america.org under resources. And it's also up there on Rumble and Spotify. Do encourage people to continue to check out our Spotify Rumble pages. Like them, share them, subscribe to them. That helps us out a bunch. And just once again, thank you, men, for being here.
You bet. Good show. Thank you.
Yep.